In a surprise move, Turkey backs Sweden's bid to join NATO.
But our ultimate goal is to join NATO, and we have 89% of Ukrainians that are in favor of joining NATO.
The House Judiciary Committee reveals the FBI working to censor Americans on social media.
The government doesn't get to censor speech because they deem it to be, quote, misinformation or disinformation.
Janet Yellen says the U.S. might respond to China's tech export curbs.
We should have a leadership strong enough, smart enough in Washington and to deal with the issue.
This is the Daybreak Insider Podcast, your first look at today's top stories for Tuesday, July 11th. I'm Mike Scott. On Monday, Turkish President Erdogan announced that he would back Sweden's bid to join NATO and ensure ratification, all but ensuring that the alliance is set to expand once again.
It's a pretty big surprise because it was only a few hours ago that we got another bombshell from the Turkish president saying that he actually wasn't going to support letting Sweden into NATO until his country, Turkey, was allowed membership in the European Union, something that has been stalled for quite a while, in part because of democratic backsliding in Turkey. And so that really seemed to signal that there wasn't going to be a breakthrough at this summit, as so many NATO leaders, including the president of the United States, had hoped, and that this was going to drag on even longer. And then suddenly, here in Vilnius, the NATO Secretary General sits down, has a meeting with Erdogan, with the leader of Sweden, and they come out shaking hands. And the Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, announces that Erdogan is going to allow Sweden's membership to go forward after all. So we don't know exactly what transpired in this meeting, but it had to be transformative, given how long Turkey has stood in opposition to Sweden joining the alliance.
The move stunned many in Europe, as Turkey had previously spent months blocking Sweden's application, accusing it of hosting Kurdish militants. As one of NATO's 31 members, Turkey has veto power over any new country joining the group. Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, described Turkey's support of Sweden an historic step, but said that there is no clear date when Sweden will officially join the alliance. Sweden and its neighbor Finland both announced their intention to join NATO shortly after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Finland formally joined in April. The two-day NATO summit begins today, and Ukraine will be high on the agenda. President Zelensky is expected to appear at the NATO summit and speak directly with President Biden. Reporter Arlette Sains is on the ground in Lithuania and explains what they know about the planned meetings so far.
Well, Wolf, President Biden will in fact sit down with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky here at the NATO summit in Vilnius, Lithuania. That's according to a official familiar with the meeting who told me that a little bit earlier this evening. Now, the meeting comes as Zelensky's attendance at the summit had been in question, but it will be one sign of unity as Russia's war in Ukraine is expected to dominate much of the conversation here at the NATO summit. These allies are also expected to discuss a pathway for Ukraine to eventually join NATO. Zelensky has been seeking security guarantees and also wants to have a more clear timeline, a more clear roadmap for how Ukraine could join the alliance.
The embattled country has routinely made their intentions to join NATO clear. They have been told that Ukraine cannot join the alliance while they are at war, as it would immediately lead to a direct conflict with a nuclear-armed Russia under Article 5. Yarena Kravchuk is a member of Ukraine's parliament. She weighs in on the reports that suggest that Vladimir Putin has met with Wagner Group leader Prigozhin.
Wagner Group is definitely a terrorist organization, and Russia, that is sponsoring Wagner Group officially from its budget, is a state sponsoring terrorism. And of course, I would say the the best days of Wagner Group in the war of Russia against Ukraine, I would say, are in the past, because they lost a lot of soldiers, and now they are trying to regroup in Belarus, but the numbers are much less, and actually the Russian Minister of Defense is trying to recruit Wagner Group soldiers. Well, I can't really name them soldiers, because they are actually convicts taken from prisons for murders, for rapes, and other very serious crimes. But of course, we will be following what they do, because staying in Belarus means that they can threaten other countries in the region, which are Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and Poland, because Belarus borders with most of these countries.
Kravchuk explains what her country hopes to hear at the NATO summit.
Well, Ukraine was not expecting to be included in NATO or grant NATO membership tomorrow during the summit of Vilnius. Of course, we understand that the war is in the very hot phase, but we would like to have more clarity than just repeating the words that we heard in 2008 when NATO said that the doors are opened and Ukraine might be a member of NATO later on. We want to hear some information, you know, some clarification about security guarantees that Ukraine might have before actually joining NATO later.
The Ukrainian diplomat believes that her country does have a lot to offer NATO.
And of course, I think it's worth mentioning that if Ukraine, when Ukraine becomes a NATO member later on, I cannot tell, of course, the time, but it will strengthen the security in the whole region. Because what happens when, you know, Lithuania, Latvia, Poland, Estonia, other countries that are in Eastern Europe are feeling threatened? They ask for more deployment of American troops. But if Ukraine will be a NATO member, our troops will be actually, you know, securing and will be, you know, the first country that will face Russia if it, you know, ever wants to attack any of the other countries. But of course, now our primary goal is to win this this war with Russia. So that's why we're expecting some packages of military help announced in Vilnius. But our ultimate goal is to join NATO. And we have 89% of Ukrainians that are in favor of joining NATO right now.
President Putin reportedly has met with mercenary leader Yevgeny Prigozhin after the failed Wagner Group mutiny last month, according to the Kremlin. Prigozhin, who heads the mercenary group, was among 35 Wagner commanders invited to that meeting in Moscow, according to the Kremlin. The Kremlin spokesperson saying that the president of Russia has given an assessment of the Ukraine war effort and the mutiny. The rebellion launched on June 23 and lasted only 24 hours. Relentless rain is flooding the Northeast, where at least one person was killed and many others had to be rescued from cars floating downstream on floodwaters. We get more on this from our Daybreak insider, Julie Walker.
Vermont Governor Phil Scott says swift water rescue teams have been hard at work, especially in the Green Mountains, where at least two towns were inaccessible.
We have not seen rainfall like this since Irene, and in some places it will surpass even that.
Tropical storm Irene dumped 11 inches on Vermont. New York Governor Kathy Hochul says parts of the Hudson Valley are devastated, with roads washed away.
9 inches of rain in this community. That they're calling this a 1,000-year event.
A woman trying to escape rising floodwaters in her home was killed.
Was with her dog, and her fiancé literally saw her swept away.
I'm Julie Walker.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
The House Judiciary Committee is claiming that a batch of subpoenaed documents show clearly that the FBI colluded with the security service of Ukraine, an agency known to be infiltrated with Russian agents, and routinely sent social media platform requests to take down accounts and posts from users. The committee alleges that the new information shows the FBI's unconstitutional role in enabling censorship and raises questions about the FBI's credibility as the nation's premier law enforcement agency. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has asked a federal appeals court to temporarily block a lower court's order limiting executive branch officials' discussions with social media companies about controversial online postings. The order came in a lawsuit filed by Republican attorneys general in Louisiana and Missouri, which claims the administration censored free speech by threatening to use regulatory action to pressure social media companies to remove what it deemed as misinformation. Republican Senator Eric Schmidt of Missouri joined the Salem Radio Network and explains that the lawsuit he filed against the Biden administration may end up going to the Supreme Court.
It was a big win for free speech and, a crushing defeat for censorship. I mean, it's got a hold, but it's a very, very positive injunction that, you know, if the government wants to challenge it, they'll go to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And I'm sure this case may or may not make it. Well, it may or may not make its way all the way to the Supreme Court. But this is the most important free speech case in a generation, at least. And so when I was AG, filed this lawsuit, Missouri versus Biden, that alleged that a bunch of different Biden administration agencies essentially were suppressing speech, mostly with conservatives.
When it comes to the White House allegedly censoring speech, Schmidt says there's now a court order to stop them from doing so.
The government doesn't get to censor speech, and they can't outsource it either. And so I was proud to bring the lawsuit. And what it says is that these agencies, from the CDC to the FDA to DHS to White House officials, can no longer do this. I mean, there's an order now on the books preventing them from engaging this kind of activity, and now the Senate will try to hold their feet to the fire.
While in years past, liberal groups like the ACLU used to defend free speech, now Schmidt says that it's conservatives who are defending the First Amendment.
It's conservatives that are pushing back and saying, wait a minute, we can have a robust debate. We can agree or disagree, but you don't get to censor speech. The government doesn't get to censor speech because they deem it to be, quote, misinformation or disinformation. And now you see these same legacy media outlets like the New York Times, who yesterday, you know, had a headline saying this will prevent the government from combating disinformation. I mean, Woodward and Bernstein are dead at this point, right? Like, this is just,
yes.
They are now the very amendment that protects their ability to write these stories and issue editorials, that protects them, they could care less because it's as long as it's sort of the content that they want or the viewpoint that they want. And they turn now into completely sort of parroting the talking points of the current regime as opposed to defending people to speak their mind.
The Missouri senator explains that it's important to allow people to speak their minds.
And in order to avoid political violence, it's very important for people to feel like they can go into the town square, speak their mind, express themselves, or the virtual town square now. And so, but the Democrats want to narrow that bandwidth of what's acceptable speech. And so you see, this is the reason why political correctness, people pushing back against that. It's the same reason why they find these kinds of instances of censorship so offensive, because they understand viscerally that we need to be able to express ourselves, and the government has no business in regulating that. But yeah, you're right. The legacy media, CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, they're losing their minds because they know that they've been in on this. Whether it was in 2016, whether it was in 2020, whether it was during COVID, they've all been working closely together. They don't like that this could get broken up.
This comes as Meta's new app, Threads, quickly found itself embroiled in a censorship controversy after warning users that Donald Trump Jr. may be a source of misinformation. Threads users who tried to follow the younger Trump were greeted with a message that read, "Are you sure you want to follow Donald Trump Jr.?" This account has repeatedly posted false information that was reviewed by independent fact-checkers or went against our community guidelines, end quote. After some major backlash, Meta's head of communications, Andy Stone, said that it was an error and it shouldn't have happened. However, many users don't buy that such a move is an accident. One Threads user posted, quote, "It's funny how errors always target conservatives," end quote. A famously progressive ice cream maker may be having second thoughts about its latest attempt at virtue signaling. Daybreak Insider's Rich Thomason has more on this developing story.
Vermont-based Ben and Jerry's call for what it terms stolen indigenous land to be returned to Native Americans may have backfired, because now one of the chiefs of a Vermont tribe says he'd be interested in talking to the company about getting back the land where Ben and Jerry's headquarters is located. Don Stevens tells Newsweek the tribe has always been interested in reclaiming the stewardship of our lands. Rich Thomason reporting.
During Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's trip to China, she announced that the U.S. may respond to what she said were unintended consequences of Beijing's curb on exporting metals used in tech. Miles Yu is a senior fellow and director of the China Center at the Hudson Institute. He's also a professor of East Asian and Military and Naval History at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. Mr. Yu joins us on the Daybreak Insider podcast to take a deeper look at the Yellen visit to Beijing. During Yellen's trip, she stated that she was concerned about the Chinese government intimidating U.S. companies in China. In your opinion, how widespread is that intimidation in China?
What the Chinese government has done is to impose much harsher regulation on American companies in particular and foreign investment in general. So they have enacted this counter-espionage law targeting specifically foreign companies, particularly those due diligence agencies. Those agencies hired by big corporations to find out the economic reality and the truth about China's investment environment. The Chinese government has really, really struck hard against those companies, the Japanese companies, the Chinese companies, and chief executives. So by definition, I mean, every foreigner in China is under some kind of suspicion. So that's one thing. Another thing is China needs the West technology, yes, but China also has a major political concern, because the Chinese society is basically dominated by the Chinese Communist Party.
Help us understand this further. What does it mean for the Chinese economy?
Their measures restricting people-to-people interaction were very, very severe. I mean, for example, the American model of commercial engagement in China, you have a direct sale. A lot of people are knocking on your door to sell goods. That will be strictly prohibited. I mean, it's definitely a crime if you do so. So there are many other things, transparency of the China's banking institutions and economic data. So those are very, very big things. So I think that Secretary Yellen was absolutely right. She pointed out the Chinese economic operations were controlled by the Chinese government.
The Chinese government announced a curb on tech exports. Do you think this is a move that sort of escalates the tension?
She told the Chinese repeatedly and emphatically that the United States is going to protect its national security. We're not going to compromise our national security for some immediate, expedient economic again with China, because China used the economic engagement with the United States by stealing a lot of American trade secrets and intellectual property rights. And we have been a sucker for decades. So that's why I think her main point to the Chinese counterpart was that we're going to put sanction on you, and we're going to basically keep all the tariffs, keep the extra control. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we're not going to have a targeted engagement with you. So this is the argument of de-risking versus decoupling.
There's a lot being said about the sluggish Chinese economy in recent months and the implosion of its local and national real estate markets. Can the U.S. leverage that in any way?
We could. The Chinese economy is not a little bit sluggish. It's terribly sluggish. It's basically in shambles. And that's a phrase that I would like to use. Because there's some structure. You mentioned about the real estate market collapse. That is a big deal, because China's development model has always been using this seemingly endless state financing, very irresponsible, some of the very risky housing market, housing projects, and some other major infrastructure projects with very little economic profitability. So now, that disastrous policy has caused the ultimate end, which is the collapse of the housing market, and along with it, the financial institutions, and you have a credit crunch. Not only that, local government is in deep debt. China's debt is phenomenal and mind-boggling. So, and with that, consumers' confidence, and also plus near 3 years of draconian zero COVID lockdowns. So millions of businesses were closed.
Now, you mentioned the COVID lockdowns. How has that affected China's internal and external economies?
That's why the unemployment rate in China is skyrocketing. And Chinese State Statistics Bureau has openly acknowledged that just the youth unemployment, the most productive group of China's population, the youth unemployment is 20%. That's almost certainly an underestimate. So you think about that. So this country is in big trouble. So you cannot stimulate the domestic consumption because people are running out of money. On the other hand, China has enacted a whole bunch of very, very unfair and tough laws and regulations that basically send the chill through the spines of foreign executives. So you have a reduced foreign investment. So it's basically a double whammy on China's economy. So I think China's economy is in big trouble.
Turning to the U.S., a lot of people are concerned about how Chinese officials and CCP-backed companies are buying farmland in the U.S. How concerned should we be?
On surface, it looks like a regular commercial transaction. But keep in mind, China is a communist country. It's a non-market economy. All major economic operations has to be compliant with Chinese intelligence espionage laws. In other words, if the state wants you to cooperate with China for geopolitical and espionage purposes, you have no choice. That's why there's a buying of the land in America right next to critical sensitive installations, particularly military installations, is very troubling. So this is the problem. This is systemic problem between U.S. and Chinese economic engagement, because you don't know what kind of economic transaction is actually driven and by the Chinese communist government. You don't know what is legitimate. So on the cautious side, that's why so many states, local government are considering banning buying American land properties by foreign nationals. So, but that is going to be a challenge in the court. So that's why Congress, in my view, has to take action to enact a whole bunch of legislature to deal with the China threat with absolute seriousness and comprehensive legislation.
Mr. Yu, in your opinion, what should people understand about the U.S.-Chinese relationship?
I think one of the most important things for us to understand that the Chinese economic activities, they're always trying to take advantage of Americans' open society and try to get away with all kinds of, illegal and illicit economic and trade practices, number one. For example, if you go on Amazon.com, about 70% of all the sellers on Amazon are from China. The reason they could do that is because we don't have any regulation to deal with this, and so a huge amount of Chinese sellers can actually evade American taxation, for example, and they can outbid American manufacturers and sellers. So that's a huge disadvantage. But then on surface, everything seems to be okay because there's no law against that. On the other hand, we should have some kind of a regulation to protect American manufacturing, American commercial entities. So issues like that, we need to really, really look into.
So what's the best way for the U.S. to deal with China economically?
That's why economic engagement in China is not just a principle of fair trade. It also touches on every American's life. So that's why it's very serious, and we should have a leadership strong enough, smart enough in Washington, and to deal with the issue from not from the managerial and transactional level, but from a more strategic and holistic perspective. And I hope that will be the case. And all I have to say to that is, God bless America.
We here at the Daybreak Insider would like to thank Miles for joining us. If you want to hear more from Miles Yu, check out his writings at Hudson.org. Or you can order one of his books, OSS in China, Prelude to Cold War, and The Dragon's War, Allied Operations and the Fate of China, from Amazon.com. And finally, be careful when texting, because the next time you send that thumbs up emoji, you may be on the hook for a contract. At least that's what happened to one man in Canada.
Emojis have been changing the game in movies, especially in communication on your cell phone.
Our day-to-day conversations full of them, but
constantly.
You have to be careful how you use them because they could land you in some serious legal trouble, we learned over the weekend. A farmer in Canada just had to shell out $82,000 for sending a thumbs-up emoji in response to a text message containing a contract from a man who wanted to buy grain. The buyer sued when he didn't get the grain, and the judge ruled in his favor, saying that that thumbs up emoji is a form of agreeing to terms of the contract that was sent.
Jesse Weber is a legal analyst and says that rulings like this one aren't just happening in Canada.
You know, I look at this case, and we've seen things like in Israel, and we're actually seeing it a little bit here in the United States. The thing that makes this case like a unique way of looking at it and kind of like a model is the reason the judge accepted the thumbs up as a way of acceptance of this contract is because he looked at the past relationship between the buyer and the seller. And whenever they had a contract or an agreement to sell wheat, there were these very short responses like, yep, okay, sounds good. And we're living in a world right now where our language is changing. A lot of us are communicating and confirming things based on emoji. So he said that thumbs up is another shorthand way of confirming an agreement. So it might get complicated down the road when you have emojis that are not so clear. So I think it's going to be a little bit of a complicated issue, but it's also really interesting from a legal point of view because this is how we're communicating with each other and courts are now seeing that.
The judge in the case admits that the case was quite unique, but stressed that the courts should now shy away from adopting and adjusting to technology. Subscribe to the Daybreak Insider podcast at Apple or Google Podcast, Spotify, or SalemPodcastNetwork.com. Get our companion Daybreak Insider newsletter each morning at DaybreakInsider.com. Ongoing coverage of breaking news and commentary at srnnews.com and townhall.com. Thanks for starting your day with us. I'm Mike Scott.